Okay, so it's really a pleasure to be here and be one of the many great people who have been talking and follow up Eric Cornell, who has shown the truly remarkable things that can be done in current experiments with rotating gases. What I want to talk about is speculations on what other interesting things one can do to achieve fun physics with these rotating gases. And I think Eric Cornell suggested some directions. I'm going to try and sort of go in other ways that have been less explored in the literature. So he mentioned this scenario of by rotating system very fast, trying to reach some sort of analog of quantum Hall physics. Some other ideas for novel states is to introduce spin degrees of freedom. And you get both intricate textures and intricate many-body states that are more complicated. And there are also some interesting questions one can ask about finite temperature and melting of vortex lattices, which I think are really fun. None of these I'm going to have time to talk about. It's just these two topics I'm going to touch on. I'm going to discuss a little bit about Subir Sachdev's scenario from yesterday about bosons near scattering resonance, which involves intricately what happens with vortices, and ask, you know, can we see some of the vortex physics around these resonances? And then I'm going to talk about rotating periodic potentials, and there is a countless number of fun results that happen there. I'm going to talk about how to produce rotating lattices and what sort of results one get. So let me just briefly repeat Subir's argument from yesterday. We have a gas of bosons near Feshbach resonance. Right? One side of the resonance, the ground state consists of a condensate of molecules. The other side of the resonance, the ground state consists of a condensate of atoms. If one asks about what sort of vortices are in these two states, on the molecular side, we have vortices where if you take a molecule around the vortex, wave function gains a phase of 2 pi. On the atomic side, we instead have vortices. We move an atom around the vortex, gain a phase of 2 pi. So if over here one took a molecule around the same vortex, a molecule is formed of two atoms, so naturally you'd expect the phase that the wave function would gain would be 4 pi. 4 pi doesn't equal 2 pi. There's something different here. And I apologize to Subir for oversimplifying his argument. Now, I think really what's really exciting here is think about, well, if there really is this difference in the vortices on two sides of this resonance, what happens if you take a rotating cloud through this resonance? Imagine you have a gas of rotating molecules that has a lattice of these 2 pi vortices. When you cross this resonance, you only are allowed to have vortices which have 4 pi. So that means two of these pairs of these vortices have to come together and bind. And I think it would be just really remarkable to be able to see this sort of physics. Unfortunately, as also emphasized in Subir's discussion, there are many problems with the scenario. And the most striking one to me is that the system is almost certainly mechanically unstable around this resonance. Right? And this mechanical instability has been recognized for quite some time. I quote this paper by Timmermans up there, though I'm not sure if that's the first one to see this. So I'm just going to give you a very simple argument to understand why, if you have bosons near Feshbach resonance, and you'd expect these mechanical instabilities. Okay? So it's a very, very simple mean field sort of picture. Imagine you can either have an atomic condensate or a molecular condensate, and there's no coupling between them. If I just look at the chemical potential of these condensates as a function of magnetic field, the molecules, which are typically spin singlets, so their energy doesn't change with the magnetic field, is drawn in this yellow line. The atomic condensate is drawn in this green line. If I then imagine turning on coupling between these two states, so I let two atoms able to combine to form a molecule, there's going to be a level repulsion between these. You've coupled two modes. And so instead of this yellow and green line, you expect some hybridized picture, these red lines, as being the energies of the states. Right? Now, the important thing here is that this coupling is nonlinear. Right? And that the more particles you have, the stronger this coupling is. What that means is that this level repulsion gets bigger as you increase the number of particles. So in particular, if you're on this lower branch, the chemical potential drops as you increase the number of particles, which means dμ dN is negative. Right? Consequently, if you have a small fluctuation in the number of particles, in the density at some locally in your cloud, that fluctuation has a tendency to grow, and the system is mechanically unstable. Right? And clearly, this is a very crude argument. I should say that I've done some exact diagonalization calculations within the lowest Landau level approximation, and they confirm this scenario that you always have effective attractive interactions if you think about this state, this red, the equivalent of that red line at the bottom. All right. So now there are experiments with bosons near Feshbach resonances, so I should include those in this picture as well. The experiments are done over here on the molecular side in this metastable atomic branch up there, which has an effective repulsive scattering length. This same argument gives us this repulsive scattering length because when the splitting between these levels become bigger, when you add more particles, the chemical potential goes up. Right? So you might ask, well, looking at this, why don't we just look at this crossover or this phase transition on this metastable branch? Well, the point is this branch is not metastable once you get close to the Feshbach resonance or past it. It's the lack of kinetic processes that allow conversion of atoms into molecules over here, which gives the metastability. As soon as you get close to the resonance or beyond it, there's no barrier to these chemical processes, to these recombination events. So, you know, this is just some wonderful physics, this pairing transition. And unfortunately, it looks like the Feshbach resonance can't give us access to it. So are there other settings in which one can see this pairing physics? And it turns out there's at least one other scenario in the literature. This is by Prokofiev, Svistanov, and Kuklov, which is if you take an optical lattice, okay, and you have two types of bosons, call them A and B, on this optical lattice, and you have a repulsive interaction between the same species, so AA and BB have repulsive interactions, and you have attractive interactions between the species, so A and B have attractive interactions between them. Then, if you increase the depth of your lattice, there can be a sort of Mott insulating transition where you lose separate phase coherence in the A and B superfluid, and you just have some combined coherence. So what you can think about is you go to a limit where A atoms can't hop because of the repulsion between A atoms and other A atoms that are on the other sides of the lattice, and B atoms can't hop, again, because there's a repulsion between those B atoms and the B atoms and all the other sites. However, if you take a pair, an A atom and a B atom, they can hop if they go together because the attractive interactions between them are strong enough to overcome this barrier. Right?
Eric, if it works for A and B, that's the opposite
of A and B. I believe that's true, though don't quote me on that. So the fun thing here is you get exactly the same pairing physics. You go from separate superfluids to a paired superfluid. And so you should also see some sort of transition in the vortices. You will have separate vortices in A and B superfluids. Here, those vortices have to pair up. Right? And so this is sort of a way to motivate the next part of my talk, which is that, well, there's some fun physics here on a lattice where we have vortices. Number one, how can we create such a situation of a rotating lattice? And number two, what other fun physics is going to come out? Okay. So I'm just briefly list some of the phenomena which one normally sees in a rotating gas and the phenomena one normally sees in a lattice. And when you combine these two bits of physics together, you get some intricate combination of the two physics. Okay. So I'm just going to go through this list, and maybe in the question period, if other people have some other ideas to include on the list, it might be a good thing. All right. So to begin with, if you just have vortices on this lattice, the vortices want to go to places where the density is lowest. And so that's places where the lattice, the potential, has maxima. And so the vortices kind of want to get pinned to the lattice. And there's some very interesting competitions here, because the rotation rate and the interaction between vortices makes them want to form a triangular lattice with a certain lattice spacing. However, that lattice and the geometry and spacing has nothing to do with what's going on with the optical lattice, with the imposed potential. And so you have a competition between wanting to be happy about the interaction with this pure potential you're sitting in, and wanting to be happy with the interaction between vortices. Just thinking on even more basic level, if you just think about the non-interacting states of particles in a rotating gas, we were just shown by Eric Cornell, they form these nearly degenerate sets of states, these Landau levels. Right? Well, whenever you have a degeneracy and add some perturbation, it's going to split that degeneracy. And so these Landau levels are split by the lattice, and they're split in a very intricate way, which I'll show a picture of later, where you get a self-similar structure in the states, in the energy levels of the states. Right? Then if you start thinking about some many-body physics in this system, any physics that's intrinsically depends upon the degeneracy of these states, if you start splitting that degeneracy with the lattice, you're going to start messing up that many-body physics. And so at least in the fermion system, people have talked about driving transitions between insulating states and quantum Hall states based on this sort of idea. Right? One can also think about just regular lattice phenomena and how the rotation changes those. One thing that everyone's very excited about on lattices is this mod insulator transition. Okay. The only thing I want to say about that with rotation is that if you do go through a mod insulator transition, you lose your superfluid, your vortices disappear. If you don't have superfluid, you don't have vortices. And so there might be something interesting with how that works. Actually related is that if you think about these correlated quantum Hall states, there is a competition between the mod insulated state and quantum Hall state. And also, lattice can actually give competition between different quantum Hall states, at least in the fermion case. And then I already discussed this idea of pairing on an optical lattice. Okay. So I think this is really exciting. There's a lot of great things here. The big question that's begged by all this is, how on earth are you going to rotate an optical lattice? Right? And so I'm going to talk about how to rotate optical lattice. And clearly, I don't have time to go into details of all of those different directions that I sort of pulled out. But I will flash a couple slides of a couple ideas. That is how to see this the spectrum of the non-interacting particles on the lattice, and how to, and I'm just going to throw up a slide on this vortex pinning. I wasn't involved with any of the work, but it looks beautiful, and so it's worth showing. So as far as I know, there's sort of three classes of ideas for rotating lattices. All right. The first sort of class is just purely mechanical. You have some, in the most crudest thing, you have your whole laboratory mounted on a turntable and you rotate your laboratory. But there are various other ideas, including you create your lattice not by interfering laser beams, but by imprinting some intensity pattern on some optical field by reflecting off some sort of grating, and you rotate that grating or something like that. There's another class which involves using some quantum optics techniques to imprint phases on the hopping matrix elements on a lattice. And I will talk a little bit more about this. And finally, just last week, I saw this idea, which is that by using time-dependent potentials and turning on and off the hopping in a time-dependent manner, you can actually mimic the effect of rotation. And it's actually a very nice idea. And actually, you can think of combinations of 2 and 3, which might avoid some of the problems of each of them. So these all have their limitations. I'm only going to be able to really talk about number 2. But before I talk about these scenarios, it's worth bringing up a few different ways to think about rotation on a lattice. The most sort of formal picture that one should have in mind is if you just take the Hamiltonian for a particle in rotating frame, just p squared over 2m minus omega dot L, and you discretize on that on a lattice, you get something that looks very much like the standard tight binding model of hopping between sites, but there are phases on those hopping matrix elements. So one way to think about how to generate rotation is, how do you generate spatially dependent phases on hopping matrix elements? Right? Another picture, which is maybe a little more intuitive, is that the important thing we want to simulate here is the Coriolis force. The centrifugal force is not so important. You always have harmonic traps, which essentially mimic that. But the main feature of the Coriolis force is that if you move radially, you get a momentum kick azimuthally. All right, so this is what causes big weather systems to rotate. It's that you have higher low pressure regions, air rushes in or rushes out, and they start rotating because they get momentum perpendicular to that motion. Right? And a third very powerful way to think about this is that rotating neutral atoms is the same as applying analogous to applying a magnetic field to charged particles. Right. And I think everyone's seen the formal analogy between those. Okay. So I'm going to talk about the second method of trying to imprint phases on the hopping matrix elements. And this idea was really first formulated by Yashkin Zoller. I probably said his name wrong. But the basic idea is, suppose you have two different types of sites which trap two different internal states of an atom. So let's just think about two strips of these different sites. One can allow a particle to hop from the A sites to the B sites if one drives a Raman transition between these two internal states. And a key thing is that the phase of the hopping matrix element that you get in that process is given by the phase of the laser driving this transition, or the difference in the phases of the two lasers, appropriately. And so if you work it out and you find that the phase of hopping between these guys is given by the recoil momentum that we gain from this laser times position. Or taking this more intuitive picture, if I hop from A to B, I have to absorb and emit these photons. I have some recoil, so I get a momentum kick when I hop. Right? And as I said, getting a momentum kick perpendicular to your motion is exactly what rotation is all about. Right? The big problem with this scheme is it works very well with two sites or two columns of sites. Scaling it up, however, is not as obvious. If you, for instance, just take A, B, A, B, A, B sites, you might get a momentum kick when you jump from A to B. When you jump from B to A, you get a kick back in the opposite direction. And if we really had rotation or a uniform magnetic field, you want to get the same kick every time you jump in that direction. Right? And so there's a fundamental sort of symmetry one needs to break. One needs to make hopping to the right and hopping to the left different. And the various tricks to do this, one is sort of the conceptually simplest, but maybe not the easiest to implement in an experiment, is instead of using two sites, use three types of sites, A, B, and C. And for instance, make lattice that's A, B, C, A, B, C, A, B, C. And you separately drive the A, B transition, the B, C transition, and the C, A transition. And so one can engineer it that when you jump from A to B, you get a momentum kick plus K. When you jump from B to C, you get the same momentum kick. And you have something circular, so when you jump from C to A, you again gain the same momentum kick. So you've gone from A to A having a net momentum kick. And this is exactly what you need to mimic the rotation. Right? And so I'd love to talk to you about actual practical implication of this. It's actually very tricky to come up with schemes that use a relatively small number of lasers. And I'm working very hard on that. And you know, people who have ideas can shout them out or write your papers on it. But right now, I'm just going to talk about a few of these simple applications that I mentioned. How is my time? Okay, great. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is this free particle spectrum of particles on a lattice with a magnetic field or on a rotating lattice. It's formally the same. And so here I've drawn sort of a classic picture. I should have made the reference to Hofstadter, where this axis going up is the strength of the magnetic field. And it's measured in units so that this alpha equals 1 corresponds to one flux quantum going through each plaquette of the lattice. Right? And then this axis here is energy. And the black dots correspond to where there are states. Okay? And so if you go down to very small magnetic fields where the lattice is not very important, you see that these sets of states sort of form, go into stripes. These stripes are exactly the Landau levels that you find when you don't have a lattice. Right? However, when the flux through one site becomes comparable to 1, when alpha becomes some reasonable fraction of 1, say we go to 1/3, you find that this picture of just Landau levels breaks down. These levels have spread quite a bit, and there are all these little gaps everywhere. Right? So, I mean, this is quite a remarkable picture that has very nice self-similar properties and really wonderful. But how can one see something like this? And actually, with Nicole gases, you have a wonderful resource, which is you put things in inhomogeneous potentials and you look at density. So if one just takes a local density approximation, and to take into account a harmonic trap, when we think about just a spatially varying chemical potential, so when we think of, say, fixing alpha at some value, like 1/3, then the center of the trap has some chemical potential out here, the edge of the trap has chemical potential down here, and the chemical potential sweeps, so you go from the outside to the center. So if you take non-interacting fermions, so spin-polarized fermions, which are essentially non-interacting at sufficiently low temperature, put them in a harmonic trap that has a rotating lattice in it, then as you go from the edge to the center, you should see the various states being filled. Then you have regions, spatial regions, where there aren't any states. So that means as you move radially outward, the density doesn't change. So you have plateaus in the density. And just to sort of illustrate this, I just took some arbitrary parameters and plotted here the density as a 2D picture and then a slice through it of fermions at this alpha equals 1/3 point where there are three bands, and sequentially over time adding more particles. And you see that at various times you have various plateaus at these three different values of density, which can be seen there. Okay. And the other thing I wanted to throw up was this idea of looking at the pattern of vortices in a rotating optical lattice. And there's two groups that have recently put out papers on this. One of the group was just looking at the case where the rotation speed is tuned so that the density of vortices is the same as the density of lattice sites. And it's really the competition between wanting a triangular lattice and a square lattice. And there's another group who was looking at both changing this vortex density and changing the strength of the pinning. And I don't think I want to go through all of these various complicated setups. But clearly, there's a wealth of interesting phenomena there. Time?
25 minutes.
25. Oh, so I have a little bit of time. Great. And so I will use my little bit of time to go into one of the topics which I said I wouldn't cover, which is adding spin degrees of freedom. And once you add spin degrees of freedom, you really have all of the phenomena of the scalar case, the no spin degrees of freedom, with a little twist added. You have a little extra complexity, so you both have variations of the quantum Hall type states and variations of these mean field states where you have lattices. And so I just want to kind of show you some nice pictures of the sort of structures you get when you combine spin with rotation in this lattice regime. So one way of thinking about this is you rotate a single component condensate, you get a vortex lattice, you rotate a multiple component lattice condensate, each of the components forms a vortex lattice. These vortex lattices are intermeshed in some complicated way, and if you reinterpret that in terms of the spin, you have very nice spatial structures. And so Fei Chao was very nice to explain the interactions in a spin 1 gas last day, so I can more or less skip that, except to say that there are really two types of interactions. There's a ferromagnetic interaction, which wants to give you a spin order parameter, a vector order parameter. And there are anti-ferromagnetic interactions for which the spin wants to be minimized. But if you look at the spin fluctuations, they're non-zero, and they form a pneumatic structure. So the spin fluctuations all want to lie in some plane, and you can change what that plane is. Right? And so there's a symmetry here, whether if you rotate by 180 degrees, a plane maps onto itself. And so this is a pneumatic. It's like an arrow without an arrowhead on it. Okay, and so the sort of pictures you get with the ferromagnetic gas, the sort of structures one finds is these sort of hedgehoggy skirmion. So spatially, the spin rotates from pointing up to pointing down. And you can form various lattices. This happens to be, if you throw in rubidium parameters, the sort of lattice you expect, where blue circles represents the spin coming out of the board, red X's are into the board. And this actually is also, I believe, the structure that's expected in helium-3A. I don't know if it's actually been verified. Has it been verified? Yeah. So it looks very much like helium-3A. Right? The anti-ferromagnetic case, as I said, you instead of having the spin order parameter, you have a pneumatic order parameter. And the structures you get are pi disclinations in the pneumatic, which are exactly what Fei Chao was talking about. One sort of interesting thing to note is that the center of these objects is actually a little core of ferromagnetism. They have ferromagnetic cores. Rotate fast, you get sort of square lattices of these pi disclinations. And yeah, here's another fancy picture of this. And so the blue and green rods, those are supposed to represent this pneumatic order. The blue and green don't mean anything. That's just giving you contrast. And then at the center are these little mushroomy things. Those are supposed to represent the spin order. Okay. And so I'm sure I'm over by now. So I just want to wrap up by saying there is a lot of exciting physics out there in these rotating gases, and there are a lot of extra bits we can add to them, whether it's spin or scattering resonance or periodic potentials, and it just gets more exciting. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric, for putting a new spin on this subject. I'm sure there are comments and questions. Leo.
It was very, very nice, this rotation. Actually, I have a question for you, perhaps also for Feijo, about this spin-wearing gas with antiferromagnetic interactions, this Z2 or pneumatic order. Earlier last year, or maybe later last year, a friend, Kalianti Sommerman, and his collaborators actually claimed that this order may not be an exact symmetry. Is this true, or Kalianti Sommerman and Yongbo Zhang, I think they wrote a paper claimed that this C2 symmetry actually should not be there using.
I'm afraid I never read that paper, so I don't know what direction they're coming from in that. I really should have, but I haven't heard that.
So,
yeah, I meant to just make a comment on the question you raised early on about the question of H over E versus H over 2E vortices.
Yeah.
Seems to me if you have a system which might or might not be energetically stable, in which you simultaneously have a Bose condensate of single atoms and also a Bose condensate of tightly bound diatomic molecules, then a crucial question is exactly how strong is the coupling which transfers to atoms to a molecule and vice versa. If it's very strong, then presumably the vortices are going to be constrained by the, as it were, the minimum element, in this case by the atom, so you'll only get H over E vortices. If it's weak enough, however, you could actually break the phase locking between the atoms and molecules, and you could actually get, as it were, H over 2E vortices occurring just in the molecular system. And this is actually something which, an analogue of this, is actually seen in helium-3A, where you have the upspin and downspin condensates. Because they're very weakly locked, you can actually sometimes form situations where one of them has a vortex and the other doesn't, or similar things. It's somewhat related, I think, to the point which Fair has risen.
I think Subir wants to make a reply to that. He's much more capable of replying to that than I am.
I guess I agree with you at some level, but if I took the H over 2E vortices in the regime with the atomic condensate, there will still be a linear force between them. It may have a weak linear tension, but there will be a linear confining force between the two fractional vortices.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In connection with this, there are, in helium-3, there are two different, you can engineer it so you have an A phase and a B phase in a vertical column, one on top of the other one. Mm. And one of them has doubly quantized vortices and one of them has singly quantized vortices. And the Helsinki group has actually done experiments on how these vortices pass through the A-B interface.
Ah.
And it's actually very, very interesting. All those come down and sort of fractionate, part of it goes out the wall along the interface, the rest of it goes on through. And they've written this up. I heard talks about it a couple of years ago, but it's really it's actually very close to this.
Yeah,
it was an old question, and they finally got around to doing the experiments of what happens when you take doubly quantized vortices and merge them with singly quantized vortices.
That's
so it's really cool. I can tell you about it.
Yeah, I'd love to. That sounds great.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question related precisely to the slide and these other discussions, just at a more elementary level, just to get it clear in my mind, like take this diagram, but this is a question also for Sabir, he could comment. So we have one region where we can have a molecular condensate, like a bound diatomic molecules, but no atomic condensate, is that it? And in another region where you just have the atomic condensate, or is there a region on your diagram there that you have both or something? I mean, this is an elementary question, I just didn't get it clear.
So we're thinking there is a regime where there's both. Is the
and on this diagram, where is that? Or, Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and that wouldn't necessarily have to be right near the Feshbach resonance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's the difference between these two papers that you mentioned up here?
Maybe
the same.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a brief question. When you said you can mimic. You can rotate a lattice without rotating the whole laboratory by modulating the matrix, the hopping matrix element. But do you also physically rotate the lattice size, the minima of the optical potential?
So without actually having any physical rotation, if you look at the Hamiltonian in the rotating frame, if you did rotate the lattice and look at the Hamiltonian in the rotating frame, it would have phases on the hopping matrix elements. Right, so there's no reference to the rotation anymore, it's just reduced to these phases. And so formally, if you can somehow mimic those phases, the physics of what happens will be identical to as if you had rotated the lattice. So you're not doing any rotation, but you're mimicking the Hamiltonian that a rotating atom would see.
Okay. Jason?
I guess I haven't really understood your statement or the scenario about what happened when as I go through the Feshbach resonance when I have a high angular momentum rotating atomic gas. So are you saying that when I have a large vortex lattice like Wolfgang and Eric, and if I push it through the Feshbach resonance, what do you predict that would the fate of the condensate?
So I've tried to do that calculation, and what I find is that when I try and push through the resonance, the system becomes unstable. The instability is it wants to break up into little clumps, and those clumps have angular momentum.
Well, one more question, and then we'll have some coffee.
I wanted to ask about this. I was confused about, you're saying that the system has this mechanical instability, but I'm confused. I mean, that's talking about the real physical systems, which the Hamiltonians in these papers by Radzikowski and Sachdev are addressing. I mean, are you saying that the Hamiltonians in these papers are somehow sick?
I'm suggesting that
the real system has a problem.
If this physics of going from an atom condensate to a molecular condensate comes from this sort of naive coupling where you just have two atoms can be converted into a molecule, right? That will give you an effective attractive interaction on both sides of this resonance. Yeah. And so the system has to become mechanically unstable near this resonance.
And that's physics that's within the Hamiltonians
that's
in these
papers.
That's
physics within the Hamiltonians used in these papers.
That's what's sick of the solution?
No, the system is mechanically unstable.
Yeah.
So the... Yes, exactly. So you can't actually see this scenario
Eric?
That stability argument applies at least on one side of the resonance to the current fermion molecule conversion experiments as well.
No, because the argument was really talking about single modes that are occupied, right? And repulsion between these two modes. When you have the fermions, you have this Fermi C that you're thinking about. And although I've never heard anyone talk about it in this language, I think you get very different.
Certainly, you can imagine going slowly enough that you are converting to a Bose condensate adiabatically during the process, and you can imagine that somewhere inside that crossing that you've got a BEC, and the same stability argument would apply.
Okay, so there's two. This is coupling between two Bose condensates, the atom and the molecule. In the fermion case, there's only one condensate that's involved.
Well, is that important?
I want to make one comment and one question about instability. The comment about the difference between fermion and bosons. For ideal bosons, we know it's infinitely compressible. Mm. So interaction is very important if one is concerned with compressibility. If it's repulsively interacting, that's a finite compressibility. If it's negative, the system is mechanically unstable in terms of compressibility. For fermions, the compressibility is finite even without interactions. So it's less sensitive in this regard. So even for BCS superconductor, the compressibility is not that much changed because of the pairing, though you know it's becoming superfluid. This is the first comment. The second one is, you have mechanical instability here, but you also have pairing instability.
Mm-hmm.
There's an issue about which one occurs first.
So this state is the state that's paired.
That's
already the paired state. We were talking about the instability in the molecules.
Okay. Now, if I start from the high temperature limit,
or if I start up here somewhere.
Yeah. If I do it in a slightly different way, if I start with very high temperature, I don't have mechanical instability because of thermal motion of atoms.
Okay, so do you have, so which side are you on? You're talking about things over here?
It is not, the axis is not here. I'm coming down from high temperature. Suppose I start with high temperature.
Which side of the resonance are you on?
Either side.
Okay.
Doesn't matter, because if I go to very high temperature, things is dominated by kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a classical gas with finite compressibility with certain sound velocity,
yep,
for instance. So if I now lower the temperature coming down, and now I want to talk about the limit where there's the scattering length is negative, so that you have.
So that is.
I don't know which side in your view. Okay, this side. I come down. Then I have two kind of instability. One is mechanical. One is Cooper pairing.
No, you don't have a pairing instability. The pairing occurs on the side with positive scattering.
Okay, then I stay on this side.
All right, so you have positive scattering.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know which side you call the Cooper unstable. I guess my question is about the computation of this between these two instabilities.
So on this side, unless you get the pairing, there's no instability. If you just have atoms, the atoms have a positive scattering length, and they're nicely stable, you only get an instability if you get a large number of molecules around, and the molecules have an attractive interaction between each other. And that's what drives the instability. It's not an attraction between the atoms, it's an attraction between the molecules.
Okay, I think time for coffee. Let's thank our two speakers again.